Well, thank you for that applause. I want to say it's nice to be here. I'm actually really nervous for some reason because I'm not absolutely 100% sure what I'm going to talk about tonight. But I thought I shall just see what comes out. Part of it will be a bit of a repeat of the talk I gave earlier today, which was at Goldsmiths College. So, hands up if you heard that one. Just two then, that's fine. Okay, just only you two then. In which case, it'll be an exact replica of that talk. but hopefully, kind of a little bit broader. In terms of the title then of the talk, though, which has changed from this afternoon's talk, because there was intention to ask something different, it will kind of be slightly broader. It's kind of a bit of a reflection on kind of where I'm at right now in terms of trying to kind of reevaluate the kind of research that I'm doing as a psychologist, research that I've done in the past, and how that's kind of inspired any research I'm making in the future. Just kind of taking stock on things. In terms of, I think, whether or not I'll cover all these kinds of topics, I don't know, but there's kind of a question of what the Loch Ness Monster, Noel Edmonds, magic eye pictures, forgiveness, and the number 42 all have in common. God knows, no idea at all, really. Maybe they could have all something to do with the meaning of life. It's one possibility. Or it could be simply the not-so-random thoughts of a man going through a midlife crisis. And my money, I think, is on midlife crisis. And as I noticed, I changed the words. So these might be some things that I also talk about tonight. I don't know yet. But I think the concern is, I'm at this kind of stage in my life where I am rethinking the world, rethinking my place in the world. And I think it probably does reflect, possibly, a midlife crisis. I'm 37, so maybe I'm a few years too early. Apparently, some research suggesting that kind of 44 seems to be the age that you have a midlife crisis. So I've got mine 7 years early, which might give me 7 years further on the other side of midlife crisis as I kind of go about my life in a slightly different way. So I'm kind of reflecting on really kind of what is life, or why are we here? Just a question: why are we here, in this room tonight? And what do we do with the lives that we lead? These kinds of questions. Starting to kind of bug me now, starting to attract my attention. And what I'm going to do then is kind of lead you through, you know, how I kind of got there, really. Sorry, my system just went, oh, it's so dark. That's why I should never think that's safe. And the reason we kind of get to this question of, why we're here, the big questions for me, and relate to some of the research that I've been involved with at Scott here, and I'll kind of give you a brief kind of introduction to what that has been. My PhD research was conducted at the University of Hertfordshire with a person called Richard Wiseman, who I think you're probably all very, very familiar with. And Richard got some funding to do research on the psychology of luck at the time. I was perhaps fortunate enough to be there to take on the role of his research assistant and eventually also register for a PhD. And in fact, the last time, other than this afternoon, the last time before that I last spoke on the topic of luck was actually at this symposium, which Richard organised at the BA Festival of Science in Dublin, just over 2 years ago, on this question, do you feel lucky? And there were these kind of eight presentations. And I was one of the last presentation on the day, and it went so badly. Well, I felt it went so badly because I felt as though it should have gone first. Because my question was, which you can't really tell on this slide, was trying to answer the question, is luck paranormal? Because one of the directions of the PhD research was addressing the question of the possible parapsychological elements, even, of this idea of luck. And kind of part of the conclusion to that is that, well, I don't think it is really very paranormal. There isn't any strong evidence, although if you look at each other, you can discuss the pros and cons of the research, but there's no strong evidence to suggest that so-called lucky people do better than unlucky people on, say, tests of psychic ability or ESP tests. So there could be something else going on. And much of that research also then focused on the psychology of luck, which is something we're going to look at more in a second. My talk at the end of that symposium just didn't particularly. I felt as though that I didn't want to speak about luck anymore. Is that I had nothing else to say about it. I'd done my PhD on it, effectively kind of assisting Richard with his research, and I was quite keen to just leave it behind and not talk about it. Which is fine now, almost two years later, I'm here talking about Look again. So hopefully it'll go better tonight. Although looking at some of the faces, like maybe not. You're looking at me like a dog that's been shown a car trick. So two blinks for yes or one blink for no. So hopefully maybe where we get on is a little bit more kind of warmth from you guys. So this question of do you feel lucky? And we had a series of presentations. So there's Richard talking about the luck factor, which we'll talk about in a second. People like Chris French, who's also here tonight, who's in the talk this afternoon, talking about psychology of superstition. All these different aspects of this notion of luck and the extent to which there could be perhaps a psychology of luck, which is something we want to explore. Now, in fact, so the question I'd asked at that conference, at that symposium, is this idea of whether or not is luck paranormal? Is there something paranormal to this notion, to this concept of luck? And in fact, probably what I was feeling at the time, at least at the time doing my PhD, starting the PhD research, was probably this underlying assumption in my mind that perhaps luck is best perceived as being normal in some respect, and that being normal in a sense of a normal distribution. So many of you probably are, if you have some mathematics, some science or stats background, and may recognise this as being a normal distribution. And lots of distributions are distributed in this way, where you tend to have a few observations down one end of the distribution, again a few observations towards the other end, and then the rest of the data falls somewhere in the middle and has a certain properties. It's a nice symmetrical bell curve. Good question, Mike.
You have much, as much warmth as you like. Could you please hold the microphone just a little bit further away?
Okay, I'm sorry.
Just a little bit.
I was hard to hold it as much as possible. Is that better?
Yes.
Is that better?
No.
Like that?
Yeah.
Okay. Is that better? Okay. Perhaps that better. So, the question of whether luck is normal. Normal distribution, heard that bit anyway. Normal distribution, maybe we've got kind of some few observations down here and a few observations up here. So in terms of luck, this notion of luck, and again we might think a bit more by luck, but I felt as though it kind of could be perhaps normally distributed. That yes, some people, things will tend to work out in their favour more often than you expect by chance. Just generally speaking, just by chance, it's just the way the cookie crumbles. So maybe the lucky people are towards this end of the distribution. That makes sense? And suddenly then, at the other end of the distribution, you have people who are, in quotes, not so fortunate. Now I'm getting told to put the microphone
toward the mouth.
Every other word, I'll pull it away a little bit like that. Like Norman Collier.
Hold it close and speak quietly.
Hold it close.
I'm getting confused there.
Where's that creationist? Is this better? Is there people losing their interest, aren't they? I'm losing them. I'm gonna just keep telling me, if it doesn't sound as though right, I shall something like this for now, until I get told otherwise. So, without labouring the point, normal distribution, lucky people at this end of the distribution, unlucky people down there. That to me seemed to make sense, that luck probably was a fairly random kind of thing. You couldn't really necessarily control it.
A single experiment.
And, you know, we tend to find that kind of this kind of distribution, so people will lead different kinds of lives. Some people may tend to find them in the lucky end of it, some people down the unlucky end of it, and for the rest of us, we're somewhere in the middle. We're somewhere kind of where some things tend to work out in our favour, and for some of us, things tend to work out against us, but they kind of even out after a while. And that was probably where I kind of felt I was, at least at the time, in terms of thinking that, yeah, luck, in my mind, probably was a fairly random distribution, kind of normally distributed in that way, and you probably couldn't do a huge amount to maybe shift yourself from down this end of the distribution up to this end. Because, again, luck is just luck, it's just random, you can't really control it. The PhD, if anything, started more focused on, okay, well, we could probably distinguish or find people who perceive themselves to be lucky, and distinguish those from the people who perceive themselves to be unlucky, and can we identify differences between those two groups of people? And maybe eventually, can you suggest ways in which unlucky people could become luckier? Or at the very least, are there ways in which people can interpret the events that happen to them? That's what I thought was probably going on. Maybe people leading largely similar lives, but the way they interpret events was different. So that's kind of where I kind of felt it was at the time in terms of the PhD research. But then, and at the time, actually, interestingly, I don't know if Richard would remember these kind of conversations, but we were quite cautious. We discussed...
You
know,
I
want
to get
your
chin.
That's what I had to begin with. It starts all the
time. Just get your chin. Honestly, they can't hear you at the back.
Okay, so only for chin, folks.
So just look at Richard, and if he starts shaking...
Do I have head?
Then you know it's a bad sign.
Yes.
You'll chop off your wallet.
Maybe I don't want Richard to hear this. Maybe Richard should they do with us all. So this here is Richard Wiseman. He looks just like the guy sat at the bar over there, who is having a heckle for me after asking interesting questions. But at the time, I don't know if Richard will remember this, but at the time, I remember as the team, with myself, Richard, and also Peter Harris, who was also on the research team. It was he and Peter that got received the funding from the European Trust. We're saying, well, wouldn't it be careful that not to kind of fall into this thing of how can you just kind of create this almost self-help guide to becoming a lucky person? Because if we have people contacting us who perceive themselves to be really unlucky, maybe they've had lots of apparently negative events happen in their lives, we can't just say, oh, it's okay, just be more positive, be more optimistic, cheer up that may never happen. It sounds a bit kind of oversimplistic when these people may well be leading perhaps quite challenging, difficult lives. So lo and behold, I was quite, you know, quite cheerfully surprised when, after finishing my PhD, Richard produced a book, All the Luck Factor, Change Your Luck and Change Your Life. Very much kind of suggesting this idea, maybe we can do things like that. And at the time, I was actually one of the most cynical people in terms of this book, thinking, well, I'm not sure if that's, if people can just simply change their luck. So remember, my perception was, oh, well, some people are just kind of lucky, things tend to work out in their favour, for some people tend not to work out in their favour, most of them somewhere in between. You can't necessarily do a lot to influence your own luck. But then having read Richard's book, I'm very much convinced he's got the right idea. And in fact, as we'll see, I think maybe it's only kind of, or to scrape the surface, it's only the tip of the iceberg. So I'll give you a very brief kind of rundown of some of the principles that Richard talks about in the book. As part of essentially initiated by some of the research that I was involved with, and since then going on to talk about other things. But one aspect is this idea of trying to maximise your chance opportunities. That we will experience, you know, kind of so-called chance-oriented opportunities pretty much all the time. Can we do things to actually increase the likelihood of those things occurring? So that's kind of one principle, which we'll say a bit more in a second. This idea of listening to your hunches, your gut feelings, maybe that's an important way in which you can, in fact, increase the chance of so-called lucky things happening to you. Expecting good fortune, expecting good things to happen, because that seems to be an important part of actually creating those things to happen. And this final idea of turning your bad luck into good. So even though you may experience bad luck, can you do something to actually turn it into something better than it appears to be? There's kind of four basic principles that Richard's identified from the research he's been conducting. So we'll go through each of those. And largely speaking, I'd say that the kind of approach which is taken is essentially comparing so-called lucky people with unlucky people, people who perceive themselves to be lucky, and comparing those with people who perceive themselves to be unlucky. And saying, here's what the so-called lucky people seem to be doing, can the unlucky people learn something from it? One idea is that lucky people seem to be able to build and maintain what it calls a strong network of luck. So what do we mean by that? This idea that lucky people tend to be more so-called extroverted, more outgoing, tend to have maybe a wider circle of friends and network of people that they will engage with and discuss ideas with. And that they would then have an opportunity for those so-called chance opportunities to bring them some good fortune. So they first of all build such a network of luck, and then they maintain it. Raising that is the idea of developing a relaxed attitude to life, which I actually think is kind of an extremely, I'm discovering myself, developing a relaxed attitude to how you go about your life. And a great experiment which conducted as part of this to kind of illustrate it is this idea that showing people where I had to look through a newspaper and count the number of photographs that appeared in the newspaper. It was a fairly simple task. It would take people a couple of minutes to do, and I think the answer was 43. It was 43 photographs in the paper. But what they could have done is taken a much easier route, which wasn't apparent at the time. But if they'd opened the newspaper, on the second page of the newspaper, a full, pretty much, I think, half-page advert basically said, "Stop counting the photographs. There are 43 photographs in this newspaper." But I think nobody spotted it. And even later on in the newspaper, there was another one saying, "Stop counting the photographs. Tell the experimenter there are 43 photographs and win £100. But nobody spotted it. Or very, very few people spotted it. Because they were so focused on counting the photographs. That's what they'd been told to do. They weren't looking for any other possibilities. Any other, you know, it was apparent there would be another way in which they could get that answer without counting them. And the idea that supposedly people who score high in terms of neuroticism, therefore are more anxious generally about their life, are less relaxed, and therefore are more prone to that, more prone to the idea they're too focused on what they feel they have to do, and they're not open to those other opportunities which may be there all the time, but you need to develop a certain relaxed attitude to notice them. So that's kind of another part of the sub-principle of this idea. And related to that is this idea then of being kind of open to experience, open to opportunities as and when they arise. Because the idea is that we have opportunities around us all the time, but it's only if we're willing to accept them as being opportunities, take them up, being open to them, being open to what they may lead to, only then are you likely to kind of find situations arising where so-called luckier things can happen to you. So that's kind of the idea of maximising chance opportunities. A second principle was this idea that so-called lucky people seem to be more likely to listen to their gut feelings. It's this idea then that the best decisions people make often are made on gut feelings. This kind of intuitive feeling that sometimes there could be a range of things you're basing that on. You're not always really 100% fully conscious or aware of what it is you're basing it on. But the overall underlying feeling is something feels right or something doesn't feel right. And people who apparently were experiencing greater good fortune, so-called lucky people, were more likely to base their decisions on those kinds of gut feelings. And then also, these people were more likely to develop then that so-called intuitive ability by things like meditation, various contemplative practices, things that would supposedly help them to be more reliant upon, or not be more reliant upon, but allowing them to be open to those kinds of gut feelings, listening to them when you have those kinds of hunches. So again, this idea that what so-called lucky people seem to be more non-lucky people. A third principle then was this idea of expecting good things to happen. Based upon the idea that if you expect good things to happen, then it's more likely that they will happen. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean if you expect good things to happen, then good things will happen, nothing but good things. But if you expect things are going to go well, they're more likely, more often than not, in most scenarios, most situations, they will go better. Any task that you set about to doing, if you believe you're going to be successful at it, you're more likely to do better than someone who believes they're not going to be successful at it. A lot of people sometimes feel as though they give up before they even started because they believe there's no point, what's the point in carrying on? And again, lucky people seem to be engaging in this kind of thinking, this kind of expectations, more than unlucky people. So, for example, yes, this idea, they're more likely to attempt to achieve goals in the first place, more likely to persevere, and so it relates to this idea that psychologists are very familiar with, this idea of a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you have a belief that certain things are going to happen, you know, have expectations that it's going to be the way, it's going to have an expectation about something being a certain way, that can actually influence it being that way. So often how you interact with other people, if you have kind of an expectation that people will be kind to you, pleasant to you, that will probably influence the way in which you are with them, which in turn will influence them being more likely kind to you, pleasant to you, generally speaking. So again, and the people in this lucky group were more likely to expect things like interaction with people to be successful. Therefore, more likely to engage them in the first place and expect them to go well. So that's the spectrum of fortune. And the final one, which I think is sort of particularly interesting as well, is this idea of turning bad luck into good. So I'm going to show you, this is a actually one of the scenarios that we generated that kind of involved research when I was involved with it, and illustrates a kind of a series of other scenarios that Richard put together, which you imagine yourself in a certain scenario, and how lucky or unlucky do you describe it to feel it to be. So here, we'll try this one. So imagine you're waiting in a bank when an armed robber enters and fires a shot. The bullet hits you in the eye. So imagine that's happened to you. How lucky or unlucky do you perceive that to be? So in the research, we would ask them to give a rating on a 7-point scale from -3 to +3. But here's now a quick show of hands then. We'll just say basically either if you give a minus rating or a plus rating. So hands up if you would describe that as being unlucky. So a handful of people, but also not everybody. So hands up then if you would perceive that to be lucky. Okay. So a similar show of hands, quite a nice split actually. And I think what's interesting is it shows you there's nothing necessarily inherently lucky or unlucky about that situation. It's how you perceive it, it's how you view it. And we can see there's a difference of opinion. So out of interest, somebody who put the hand up and thought it was unlucky and is willing to share with the group, would you like to say anything about why you would perceive it to be unlucky? Okay.
Because the chances of being involved in that scenario were so remote that being hit in the arm is very unlucky. Being killed, of course, would be very, very unlucky. But you've still only got like a 1 in 100,000 chance of that ever happening to you in your life.
So it's a very unlikely event. It's very unlucky.
You could get even more unlucky, but that's still pretty bad.
For anybody else who gave a description of being unlucky? I'm interested in any other explanation for unlucky. You felt so, just because it was so remote, so unlikely.
How could I have a wank if I got shot in the wrong arm?
I'm not sure how, if I want to respond to that.
Well, that'd be over.
You
can't
want to be dexterous.
Anybody else who gave a report? Quite a few hard arms handed up for unlucky. Okay?
It just is a bad event. It's a very poor outcome. As Michael said, it's remote, and your chances of it happening are unlikely. So you've had bad luck anyway.
Okay. Interesting. Let's hear from some people who have rated being lucky. So how do you thought it was lucky, and you can explain why you thought it was lucky?
I would say it was lucky because it could have easily been a shot which hit one in the chest, and the chest is much bigger than the arm.
Okay.
So it's lucky.
Okay. So, and I think that seems to be where people rate this kind of event as being quite lucky overall, is they're comparing to, as you kind of touched upon, you still felt it was quite unlucky in and of itself, that things could have been much worse. And often, in fact, when you listen to people who are talking about being unlucky, they are imagining how things, which may be implicit to what you're saying, how things could have been better. Now, first of all, the fact that simply being in a bank when somebody fires a shot in itself sounds quite unlikely to happen. To be shot in the arm, particularly unlikely, but you may be imagining how things could have been better, the fact the shot could miss you altogether. But for people who are rating it as being lucky, very much so are engaging in what psychologists call counterfactual thinking. You're comparing what actually did happen with what might have happened. And in fact, you're imagining how things could have been far, far worse. So therefore, overall, the idea that this kind of event is very lucky. On the whole. And not surprisingly, our so-called lucky people who generally perceive themselves to be lucky, were more likely to rate this kind of event as being lucky themselves, overwhelmingly. So again, suggesting that maybe lucky people are able to, as and when bad things do happen to them, they're able to see how things could have been far, far worse. Just kind of being grateful for things not being as bad, much, much worse. Also this idea that these people are able to take a long perspective. That often when something bad happens, they don't necessarily see it as being bad in itself. They think, well, in the bigger picture, something can often still come good from what appears to be bad. So in one of the descriptions from that previous scenario, someone said, yeah, I think it's quite lucky to one aspect of it. It could have been shot in the chest, could have been killed. But in fact, maybe I could earn some money from being interviewed by the press afterwards for being shot. So it's an opportunity to maybe, draw some income out of it. So it's seeing ways in which you wouldn't normally think of it, but you think, well, maybe that's a way in which you could, in the long perspective, see something more positive. And often in life generally, you think, well, something bad happens, and the event itself may seem quite negative or unlucky, but taken in a broader perspective, a longer perspective, things often do work out for the best. You're able to look at it more, if that happened that way, then maybe this more positive thing would have happened afterwards. Also, tending not to dwell on the bad luck, recognising that everybody experiences bad things, so-called bad luck. It's not as if the lucky people are experiencing nothing but good luck all the time. But when bad things happen, they don't dwell on it. They figure out that, well, something bad has happened. The more I dwell upon it, it doesn't really change it. It doesn't make it go away. What I should do is try and learn from it, move on, and just let go of that past event. They don't dwell on the bad luck. And also, it's not just simply kind of, oh, well, I'm just kind of coping what's happened to me, not really kind of letting it affect me too much. But then often continuing on from that is that they would take constructive steps to prevent bad luck happening again in the future. So if something bad happens, might use that to learn, say, well, what can I do to change this so it doesn't happen again in the future? So again, more like to attempt to achieve goals in the first place, and perhaps more like to persevere even after they fail. So that was a very brief kind of overview of Richard's book, which I'm not on any commission, but I'm not trying to sell Richard's book at all. But I do think it's a good read. It's available in lots of very good bookshops. I'm probably wearing some rubbish ones as well. But it's in terms of generating to think about the extent to which we can do things to control our luck. And again, recognising that luck in general terms isn't just, say, winning a lottery or winning a kind of competition. It's those things in life where things you often feel as though are beyond your control, perhaps you can do things to exercise control over them. So recognising then that so luck can be tamed in some way, in some respect, in terms of those principles of the luck factor. And so after giving that talk just over 2 years ago, where again Richard would have probably expanded on those ideas far better than I could have done tonight. But I was saying again, thinking, well, okay, that's all very interesting. I feel as though I have nothing else to kind of contribute to this area of research on luck. And I left it behind. But I find myself being drawn back to some of the ideas, because I think there's some important things being said there, and perhaps it's just this tip of the iceberg. So maybe there are also kind of further secrets to a so-called lucky life. And I'm not necessarily thinking this term of being, I don't need to kind of draw into the notion of, well, is it luck or is it something else? But in terms of living a life which things tend to work out more than they're not working out, basically. So then a further secret to a lucky life. I basically want to just kind of go through a number of general ideas as they've kind of occurred to me as possible ways in which explanations for why those factors may work, why they might be quite successful, and also maybe even kind of additional concepts, ideas that may be kind of added to those initial principles that Richard's described. And the first thing is something related to such a kind of ripple effect. So, based on this kind of analogy to when you throw a pebble in water, a pond, of course ripples will just go out in all directions and keep going on for some time. And it's kind of recognising that kind of effect in our everyday lives. The reason why some of those factors may be so successful, so effective, or can be so effective and so successful, is that every action that you do, this sounds like safely obvious, it is safely obvious, but for me it's a bit of a kind of realisation to acknowledge how important this is, that every action you do has a consequence. Other than that consequence will have a consequence and so on. So any time you do something which appears quite small, so maybe we'll be just smiling at the person or allowing somebody else to, letting another person in driving in front of you, that will have a consequence. By letting somebody in front of you when you're driving, which means they'll get to their destination that little bit earlier than they might have otherwise done. And I think all those kinds of actions you do in your life, how much of a consequence they have, even though you're not always aware of those consequences, because you don't see them in other people's lives, or sometimes they have a pretty major consequence in your own life sometime down the line. But because they're more than a few weeks, months, years ahead, you don't always think together. So this idea that small actions at one point can have quite large consequences somewhere else. So related to that is this notion of the butterfly effect as well. Is that, and my understanding is this notion of this phrase that in terms of predicting weather, the reason why it's so difficult trying to predict weather, I think it's often phrased the expression as, does the flap of a butterfly's wings in Brazil cause a tornado in Texas? Not very often, as we say. And often when I would hear that, I think, well, no, of course it doesn't, because how could something so small over there have such amazing drastic consequences on the other side of the world? But I'm now feeling as though, well, maybe I can, the principle behind that is that, yes, well, a very small action, in terms of relating back to our own lives again, can have sometimes a very, very large consequence at another time for another person that you can't ever really predict because your action doesn't seem to be that close to it. And it's this idea that maybe, well, once you change one part of an action, it has such a huge knock-on effect. The one film I like is in terms of illustrating it, and it's kind of one of my favourite films from my childhood. Has anyone seen the film Back to the Future?
Yay!
We've got some fans of Back to the Future. Well, finally, I found the level we're at now. Let's talk Back to the Future. And in fact, from one of my classes last year, when I was discussing with them, the one thing I asked them to kind of write down as their notes from that class, if nothing else, was watch Back to the Future. With some of them, frankly, now being almost 20 years younger than me, have not seen the film. So those of you who've not seen the film, or Leave Me Rind of It, it's obviously about Marty McFly, who goes back into the past, and then, as a consequence of everything happening, some things get changed slightly, and when he comes back to the present time, things are so different. And what's actually happened is that at a dance which his mother and father met, his father actually kind of punched the school bully. And as a consequence, then people thought all the time, well, that's amazing, maybe you should run for class president, maybe you should do this, maybe you should do that. And as a consequence, back 30 years later, when Marty McFly, our hero, returns to the present time, everything's different. He's now in a nice house. The guy who was once a school bully is now polishing his car, a brand new car that he never bought at the time, suggesting that one event that changed 30 years earlier had that hugely massive consequence 30 years later. It's a nice idea for a film, but for me, it's quite a big thing. Well, yeah, maybe those things, you can't always be sure how little actions you take have these huge effects at some point, maybe in a week's time, maybe in a year's time, maybe in 30 years' time. So this whole notion of the butterfly effect may also be something that we can draw upon. Also, I feel as though this notion of taking control and relinquishing control. I believe that the Serenity Prayer, which I also understand. Well, the Serenity Prayer is something along the lines of, as I hope I'm correct, bless you twice, is that kind of asking for the courage to control, or the courage to change the things I can change, the serenity to accept the things I can't change, is important, and the wisdom to know the difference between the two. And I also gather that's actually a prayer at the beginning of AA meetings.
Get in the bar, like this.
Yeah, that's right.
Only because he just told me.
And that's not the reason I'm drinking water tonight. But as a principle, I think, again, it's a very profound and important statement. It's this idea of realising that there are events you can control, which I think is kind of what one of the themes, emphases of Richard's book is to say, well, some things that appear to be like luck, appear to be just fortuitous, things which you don't really have control over, or so it would seem, you possibly can do little things, but in the long term can have beneficial positive effects, therefore look like you're controlling your luck. So it's being able to realise you can take control, but effectively you are in control, you can do things to take control of your life. But at the same time, there are times where you have to realise the things you perhaps can't control. So sometimes we're not always very good at relinquishing control. So it's we're not always having the wisdom to know, oh, actually this is something I actually can't control, maybe it's something I can. I think often we tend to feel as though we can control events that we actually probably can't control. So we can't necessarily do anything about, you know, when we were born, being born into a certain country, a certain time of, you know, the history of the world. These aren't things we can't do anything about. We have to accept those kinds of things. There are other things in our life we can do things about, but we feel as though we can't. Maybe the job we're doing, the relationship we're in, these all feel as though, well, we're kind of in this situation now. But you can realise you're always able to make decisions and make changes. So it's these two ideas again, which I think are important underlying the notion of this kind of auditory call the luck factor, perhaps. My impression anyway. This seems to be important. Related to that as well, which seems to be kind of somewhat contradictory with the kind of taking control, but there's more linked to this relinquishing control. And for me at least, and again from personal experience now, is that accepting that sometimes, and often guys, you have to go with the flow is a good thing. And with this, I'm not necessarily saying, oh, just going with the herd. This idea that in psychology of study, this idea of conformity, that by the way, we often will, in most aspects of our life, we are conforming. We're doing it now. You're sitting there. You're listening to me, I think, at least. You're staring at me. It's very listening to me. Wishing you were the creationist guy turned up after all. But you're acting as though you're listening to me then, and I'm standing to do. We're engaged in the role, we're conforming to some degree. And we go to work, we buy houses, we get more. A lot of these things are, it's simply we're conforming to what's expected of us. And I wanted to say that going with the flow is in that nature, just going along with the herd, not thinking of yourself. But in terms of life generally, sometimes when you start realising that maybe something's not working out, something's not happening. It's almost like you get the signs that this bad thing happens, that bad thing happens. For example, when speakers aren't able to turn on Tuesdays, maybe it's telling you you should be having a talk on Tuesday night. Maybe, who knows? Maybe sometimes people think, okay, think that you can see that as a something somewhere. That's almost an analogy, really. It's kind of saying, well, maybe you can then make changes. But again, you've got to think examples in your own life where you try something again and again, you keep trying, it's not working out, and eventually you change tack, and lo and behold, it all works out much more as though there's a flowing aspect to it. And again, it's a kind of almost very spiritual, if not pseudo-spiritual kind of approach to it, and as being someone who's now a self-confessed spiritual junkie, I'm trying it out, I'm going with the flow, and often, if I wasn't going with the flow, I wouldn't be here tonight. So I would have said yes to doing the talk tonight. Okay, maybe that's an example of where I should have said no. But this idea of going with the flow again, this idea that maybe there is kind of a path, as it were, we should be going with, and kind of when you get the good luck, things work in your favour, that's the thing that kind of keeps you going along. And I think it's kind of quite a spiritual idea that life, I don't think, is like a flowing river, and you kind of go with this flow. And I'm starting to quite like that idea. So a couple of other things then I wanted just before. 40 minutes. Surprise myself. I'm going to 40 minutes. Is these ideas of karma and also destiny? What we at least these are kind of attractive now. So at least there's a lot of things. These other perspectives. When I in some of the initial interviews that I was involved with for the Luck Project, talking to people who perceive themselves to be very lucky, one couple in particular kind of described this idea of, well, yeah, I think we're really lucky, but you know, we can control our luck. We actually said, use those terms, but we tend to be quite good people. We tend to be pleasant people, we tend to do good things, and I think as a consequence, good things often don't happen to us. And I think it's quite a very simplified kind of viewing of what we mean by kind of karma. I think I'm not an expert on it, I know people have more ideas in terms of it's a much, much bigger picture than that, but it simply kind of relates to this idea that at some level, if we do good things, then maybe that increases the chances of good things happening to us. And when this couple in particular mentioned that, being a kind of good, dutiful research system, I noticed it down thinking, yes, it's all very interesting, it's great, it's a great report, it's a great quote there. But in my head, I was thinking, yeah, but you're wrong. I really felt as though, yes, nice idea, nice to actually think like that. But fundamentally, I felt as though, well, I don't think that's the case. I have lots of examples knowing that good things happen to bad people, bad things happen to good people, it's not a principle you can rely on as such. And psychologists, have kind of shown interest in this, particularly from this idea of a belief in a just world. That we often do act as though we believe the world, the universe, whatever, is fundamentally a kind of fair and just place. When we think about it, I think, well, no, I don't really think of that at all. But often people behave in a way as though it seems to be they're relying on that kind of assumption. So, for example, often we walk on the street, you see something lying on the floor, face down. You're probably thinking, well, they're probably a drunk, they're probably a drug addict, they probably got themselves there, they don't have themselves to blame. And often you use an example, that's why people might justify not helping them, or it's not fun to help them, basically. When you might ask people if they would help, it's, yeah, of course they'd help in that situation. But in practice, people often feel as though, no, well, there is fundamentally a justness to it. And again, psychologists, what they do is tend to then develop scales in which you measure these things, and lo and behold, you find some people score highly in terms of believing in this kind of just world, and some people less so. So that's kind of where I was at the time, but you know, now, my newfound perspective, maybe thinking, well, maybe is there something to it? And actually, what I'm finding now is not so much being influenced or inspired as much, but maybe I should be, by all the great philosophers and the great psychologists, or I think they all have things to say on this very much so. But a bit like with Back to the Future, another TV show that I find particularly talking about this is, anybody seen My Name is Earl?
Yeah.
But again, those of you who haven't, and it's brilliant, I missed it the first round, but the first series of this, I think it's really good, and I think it touches upon his ideas. For those of you who haven't seen it, this is Earl, and he is kind of someone who is a thief, a drunk, someone who hasn't really done much good in his life. And in the first episode, which is kind of in the opening titles of each episode, it showed him winning a scratch card. His scratch card wins $100,000. He thinks he's got a great, great good luck. So he's dancing around, skipping around, great, sort of dancing to the street, and then the car comes along and knocks him over straight away. And he's now in a hospital, and he's thinking, well, whenever, you know, bad things always keep happening to me, even when something currently good happens, straight away something bad happens afterwards. And while he's in hospital then, he's watching a TV show, it's Carson Daly on the TV show, talking about, oh, his approach to life is, he tries to do good things, he tries to, you know, if he tries to do good for people, then good things apparently happen to him. So Earl seems to attribute this whole idea of karma to Carson Daly on his TV show. But it inspires him to lead his life differently. So he makes a list of all the things that he's done in his life he thought were bad, and he's to go back and make them good, and you know, become a good person. And then makes the series is following him, going through, crossing things off his list to see how he makes things better. And it's a nice way of demonstrating how, first of all, he goes back to the people he was horrible to at school, you know, talking about a bully or been horrible to, and now see, 20, 30 years on, how it's affected their lives. They've become such a different type of person because of how he acted to that person as a child. So he goes back to try to make it good, and you see by doing this good thing, supposedly how it has all its kind of butterfly effect, its knock-on effect. Whether or not it's enough to say, yeah, there's such a thing as karma, I don't know. But again, maybe there is something behind this idea that if you do good things, you're pleasant to other people, you probably are going to increase the chances of other people being pleasant to you. Doesn't necessarily mean if you're a pleasant person, everyone's always going to be nice to you, but you're about to increase the chances of other people being pleasant to you. So maybe, in a very superficial way, there's something to that, whether or not it's something... I'm sure those will have far more to say in terms of the karma as a more underlying principle. But then finally is this kind of idea of this notion of destiny. Like another film, which I find inspiring, which is something we think about today as I'm jumping on and off tubes. The film Sliding Doors. Has anybody seen the film Sliding Doors?
Yeah.
Again, for those of you who haven't seen it, it's been a while. Gwyneth Paltrow is the lead character in it, and at some point in the film, she's running down some steps to get on a tube. And basically, what happens is, in one version, she gets on the tube, so she's got sliding doors. She just misses. She's on the tube. She's on the train. And the other version, she just missed it. So basically what happens in the film, it follows these two kind of parallel stories, imagining though it is split into two kind of parallel universes, but it's all into that kind of interpretation of it. If nothing else, it illustrates that, or imagine if you either got on the train versus just missing the train. Would it make any difference at all? And it kind of shows these two stories how suddenly it becomes kind of branching off in two completely different directions. Where in one version, because she's got on the train, she gets home earlier, she catches her boyfriend in bed with somebody else, that ends that relationship, and so on, she leaves that person and goes and meets somebody else. Whereas in the other version, that doesn't happen, she becomes her two different characters. Think of anything else that reflects the idea that, how many sliding doors moments do we have every day, where something you do something, you go that way, or you go this way, you decide to say yes something, or no something, you know, would it have all those kind of knock-on effects? But also, for those of you who remember the film, I won't spoil too much for those of you who might be thinking of going to see it. Go to see it, so it's on the cinema, rent it on DVD. Is that it's an idea that towards the end is that things they kind of converge back again. That something still happens, which happened earlier in one version, happens later on the other version. And again, at the time, I first saw thinking, oh, it's a nice idea, a nice poetic way to kind of finish the film. But it got me thinking, or is this idea, because we don't have this control condition in our lives, we don't get to know what would have happened if we hadn't got on the train. But is there some idea that maybe that no matter what you do at some level, this is true all the time, there's some kind of things that are going to happen anyway? Or at the very least, is this idea that if we pay attention to certain cues, if we kind of listen to our hunches, if we're going to, say here, is that again, the kind of luck factor principles we talked about earlier, can in some way, can they help us kind of realise our destiny? Can they in some way shape our futures? And again, I think it's an interesting idea, which I'm sure you'll have some thoughts on. I'm not sure to say, yeah, I think basically we all have this personal destiny, but I'm interested in particular, and this is kind of probably where I think my research probably is going to go now, in terms of looking at those people who at least feel that they take control and at least feel as though we can shape our destiny and do something about it. People kind of follow our dreams. So the kind of final slide was just talk about this guy in particular, who's someone really who inspired me in kind of one way, who is this chap. And the guy is called Steve Felton. Anyone know who Steve Felton is? Heard his name? Okay. Well, interestingly, he's got a clue here. This is Loch Ness. He is the only full-time Loch Ness monster hunter. So about 15, 16 years ago now, if not more, 17 years ago maybe, he decided to sell his house, bought a camper van, pack in his job, and because he was kind of obsessed with the Loch Ness monster, the possibility of maybe getting evidence of what that is, that there's something going on there. Sold his house, got his camper van, and travelled on up to Loch Ness, and is still there now, I believe, on the shores of Loch Ness, all year round, being the only full-time monster hunter. And people might think, well, yeah, idiot, why are you doing that? Surely he's mad. But at one level, what I find inspiring is that, well, it's what he wanted to do. He would say, well, is he the person mad who's going to do that? Or is it the person who just goes along with a job they're not enjoying doing, paying for a mortgage, a house they're not able to keep particularly? Now, which is the best way to live your life? And there's not saying any right way, but for me, I found this guy particularly inspiring because I saw a TV program at the time when I was considering what I want to do after my degree, maybe I want to do a PhD, that kind of stuff. And he brought this idea, well, life is what you make it. Life is, you can control and shape your destiny. So I'm very interested in now exploring those people who, yes, feel as though they have followed their dreams, what distinguishes those people from the people who maybe feel as though they have dreams they'd love to pursue, but feel as though they can't do anything about it, that they can't take that control. And I guess on that final bombshell, I shall leave it there, and thank you very much for attending.